if the witness is unavailable at that point under the medical exception.
I'm sorry, could you please?
Is it possible for a testimony to be inadmissible against an available witness under Crawford, but nonetheless be admissible against an unavailable witness under the medical exception to the hearsay rule under Ohio against Roberts?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because the rules of evidence require a completely separate inquiry from the question presented by the Confrontation Clause, which, as I keep repeating, is a procedural guarantee. While the rules of evidence are concerned with the ultimate reliability of statements that a court will allow to be entered, the Confrontation Clause insists that that reliability be tested by a certain procedure. And in this case, by putting KG's statements into court through the mouth of a government agent, the trial court improperly imported an aspect of the inquisitorial system into our adversarial one, and that is a system which, under Crawford and under the Confrontation Clause, must be dishonored.
When we deliberate, we've heard a number of factors relevant to the analysis. When we deliberate on this, what one factor do you hope we place particular emphasis on in determining whether this was testimonial or not?
It's hard to put my finger on one factor because I believe it is a circumstantial analysis. There may be a few key factors I would like the court to focus on.
How about
on.
Your top three?
My top three. I think the court should pay particular attention to the fact that these statements were elicited as part of an ongoing criminal investigation, following right on the heels of the detective's long interview with the child. My second would be that this served no real medical purpose, that the child had already been seen, there was no ongoing emergency, appellant had been removed from the home. So under the Davis analysis, there was no ongoing situation that needed to be attended to in this circumstance. So I would say that those are probably two of the key factors that the court should focus on. And I do see that I have pretty much run out of time.
You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. In light of my contention that KG's statements made to Ms. Sievers were testimonial in nature, I respectfully request this court to find that admission of those statements through Ms. Sievers violated the defendant's constitutional right to confront the witnesses against him under the Sixth Amendment, and I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge members of the court. My name is Captain Philip State, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Francis Kiley, represent the United States government in this case. Your Honors, the lower court, the erroneous admission of KG's videotaped statement was harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt because it contributed little, if any, and did not have a substantial impact on the findings or sentence.
How can you say that in view of what the judge said on the record that basically said, he's weighing this. This goes to credibility. He wants to look at her. He wants to observe her unfiltered. And doesn't that go straight to credibility? And isn't this really the, since she didn't testify, isn't this the only way he can judge her credibility?
Certainly, Your Honor, yes. The credibility is a factor for, in this case.
Then how do you say it's harmless error?
Because, as Judge Baker alluded to, Your Honor, in looking at the impact, and also Judge Ryan, what is the impact that this evidence had on the verdict? And here, the erroneous submission of this videotape statement had little, if any, impact on the findings.
Would that be true if we believe that the lower court erred in admitting appellant statements?
I would say yes, Your Honor, it would be. Because if you look at the remaining evidence, and looking at it, there was sufficient corroborating evidence. In other words, it was very slight that it raised an inference of truth as to the acts that were committed here, as well as his intent.
Can I take that one step further? For the sake of argument only, knock out Nurse Sievers' testimony and knock out the January 3rd statement, if you would, and then articulate why, beyond a reasonable doubt, each of the elements of the offense would have been satisfied with the remaining evidence.
Your Honor, first we have the remaining three witnesses who also testified in this case, KG's excited utterances, which were properly admitted at trial. That statement was that the appellant was, quote-unquote, laying around naked. We have Ms. Sondra
Those
Freeman.
Those were the utterances to the mother?
Yes, Your Honor, which was the day that constituted the indecent liberties conviction. It was the same day. In addition, Your Honor, you have Ms. Sondra Freeman, a family friend, who testified to the depictions that Cagey made in terms of being Daddy's pee-pee. I saw Daddy laying naked. In addition, you have Ms. Valerie Sievers, who testified, the same here, concerning non-testimony.
Judge Baker's asked you to knock out, I think,
Sievers.
And the January 3rd statement.
Arguably, your worst case outcome, which is you lose on issue 2 and 3, and now you're arguing issue 1 in the context of having what left, and that's for you to answer.
Yes, Your Honor. Also, you have Cagey's mother, who also testified that she asked the appellant, how can a 5-year-old girl while bathing with her turn you on? And he admitted, I don't know, maybe I was thinking about you. And certainly, this is an admission by the appellant that he committed the act. And in conjunction with that, Your Honor, in his 7 January statement, he does give it that this touching did sexually arouse him. His defense was that it was unintentional arousal, which the appellant counsel is now trying to argue to this court.
Finish your catalog?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how can we be confident in your view that nonetheless the other evidence didn't impact or sway the verdict?
Your Honor, because in this situation, the videotape statements, assuming in this situation they were properly admitted, and as well as his statements, that in this situation with assignment error number one, that the videotape statement was cumulative. The statement.
Well, I'm knocking out, this is my follow on, I'm knocking out 2 and 3 as well, Sievers and January 3.
Yes, Your Honor. Then you're left with the admission. Then again, Your Honor, you're left with the admission that the appellant made to his wife that touching Cagey turned him on, showering, and which constituted the indecent acts conviction. Also, in that 7 January statement, he does admit to that that touching did turn him on. You also have, again, the excited utterances of Cagey that the appellant was laying naked, as well as Ms. Freeman, who talked about the...
And is there a social worker in play as well?
There is Dr. Lehman, Your Honor. Finally, I was going to mention him, that he also admitted in his initial counseling with Cagey on 11 February that, she mentioned that the appellant, she had touched his cooter. So the combination of that evidence, Your Honor, when adding that up together, would establish the appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But Judge Baker, going back to what you alluded to just in terms of this analysis, what the lower court did here was in paragraph 2 on page 24 of its opinion, it looked at both sort of harmless error analysis approach. It said first that if you take Cagey's statement and completely take it out of this court's deliberations, you would still find beyond a reasonable doubt that the remaining evidence proves the appellant's conviction. And that certainly is evident here from the testimony of, again, 4 witnesses, the excited utterances that Cagey made to her mother, Ms. Freeman that we've talked about, Your Honor, as well as Ms. Valerie Sievers, her testimony concerning Cagey's non-testimonial statements, which were properly admitted at trial. The second thing, though, Judge Baker, what it also did was they then turned around the lower court and also said this evidence still was cumulative at best concerning the statements that Cagey made in the videotape. They're the exact same statements that if you look at that these witnesses also later testified at trial. Again, appellant laying around naked, Daddy, I touched Daddy's cooter. These are the exact same statements that the other witnesses testified to, as well as the documentary evidence that was properly admitted. So the lower court appears to have adopted sort of both the harmless and error analysis approaches, taking the videotape out and looking at the remaining evidence, as well as looking at that erroneously admitted piece of evidence itself and comparing it to the impact it had when looking at that the other evidence that was admitted at trial. Under either analysis, Your Honor, that this court takes, the evidence still shows beyond a reasonable doubt that that error was harmless.
Counsel, did the lower court evaluate, and we can do this as a matter of law here, did the lower court evaluate the harmlessness of the statement if both the videotape, if both issues 2 and 3 were decided against the government?
It did not, Your Honor, no.
Well, my question there is somewhat unique to the military justice system, where the Court of Criminal Appeals has to evaluate the evidence and determine beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt. If we were to determine that there was error on issues 2 and 3, and if we were to agree with you that there's no legal error with respect to issue 1, wouldn't we still have to return this case at least to the Court of Criminal Appeals for them to conduct their Article 66 analysis as to whether guilt was proved beyond a reasonable doubt?
I would say no, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because if you take that evidence out that's dealing with issues 2 and 3, the government submit that the evidence, and considering this court's de novo review for issue 1, would still find that the evidence proves the appellant's guilt for their two offenses beyond a reasonable doubt. At the outset, Your Honor, this was a military judge-alone trial. In that videotaped statement, KG referenced several sexual acts that were committed by the appellant. The military judge found him only guilty of two. And that concerned the same indecent acts and indecent liberties that the appellant was convicted of. With respect to Specification 3, the military judge found him not guilty because he properly found that he had not formed the requisite intent on his first commission of this act. But by the later commission, of which constituted Specification 4, he had formed the requisite intent and knew that his actions were wrongful.
That would allow us to conclude that the evidence is legally sufficient under the very low standard for legal sufficiency, but why wouldn't we then be required to return the case to the Court of Criminal Appeals because they have to affirmatively decide something that they did not decide below, and that is in the absence of the admissions, in the absence of Ms. Seaver's testimony, and I know you're not conceding this, and we haven't made a decision, but if we were to decide that those are out, they haven't considered whether the evidence is sufficient as a matter of fact to convict the appellant beyond a reasonable doubt.
I would say, Your Honor, that there's still, based on the record, as a matter of law, that in applying the facts that are contained in the record, that the evidence was still sufficient to find the appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for the indecent acts and for the indecent liberties. So I would say it wouldn't have any sense.
Thanks.
Yes. So, Your Honor, under either harmless error analysis approach that this court decides to take, being it under the majority of in U.S. v. Simmons, taking that piece of evidence out or considering its impact alternatively with the remaining evidence which was properly admitted at trial, the government submits that the end result is the same, that that error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
On issue two, I'm sorry, were you? You're up.
I was done, Your Honor. I was just going to ask Chief Judge Everett. There's no further questions. I'll move to issue two.
On issue two?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are advancing in your brief the reasonable witness test. Has not this court already determined in Magyari and Rankin that we are going to apply a factors approach and identified a number of factors rather than a single dispositive factor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Crawford issues?
Yes, it has, Your Honor. The government would submit, though, that in dealing with that analysis, particularly with United States versus Rankin, obviously a proper question is, was the statement solicited by or made in response to a prosecutorial or government inquiry, which we do not have here. The second factor that this court laid out was purpose.
Am I to understand from your response then that you're not seeking rejection of a factors approach? You're trying to highlight a particular factor and move it to the head of the line in this case?
I would highlight those two, Your Honor, as well as considering all the facts, and it's a contextual analysis, but what this court must consider is the age of the victim.
But you're not arguing then that the reasonable witness standard that you've approached is a dispositive factor or a threshold test?
I would say, Your Honor, that's something for this court to consider and that the government would support it if the court adopted a reasonable child standard. But if it decided not to and adopted a reasonable person standard, certainly as the Supreme Court's upheld it.
Reasonable person, reasonable witness standard as the test or as one of the factors?
As the test, Your Honor.
So you are asking us to, in effect, overrule the principles of law presented in Magyari and Rankin?
No, Your Honor, I would say with determining whether a reasonable person would believe that the statements were going to be laid or used at trial, this court has to focus, as it did in Rankin, on what the primary purpose behind those statements were. And looking at the primary state purpose here, what is absent from Amica's argument and from appellant's argument is what Ms. Seavers testified to under oath. The primary purpose why she asked KG these questions was to elicit a proper medical history so she could, one, assess whether there was abuse, two, determine if any injuries, and three, refer her to treatment if necessary, which did occur.
Where in the record do you document that was the proper primary purpose?
Your Honor, if you look at, I believe, indulge me, it's page 241 of the record. The Seaver specifically testified that we also elicit a history in order to determine diagnosis and treatment. Those are the primary reasons for getting a history from the child, as well as getting information from the mother and explain why we're going to be conducting this examination.
But isn't that a little suspect in this case? Here you had an examination by the Army Hospital. The Army Hospital did not make a medical referral for any further examination. Then law enforcement got involved. They made this referral. They asked for a forensic exam, which means for use at trial. The person, Ms. Seavers, is a forensic, does forensic exams. She teaches it. That's one of her basic purposes. They paid for that. The statement on the exam release form that her mother signed said that this will be supplied to law enforcement. It seems to me that in a situation like that, it's difficult to argue that this was only for treatment, particularly where the treatment recommended was follow-up by the Army Hospital.
Your Honor, if I'll take your question just in terms of starting with 29 December 2001, first, the only evidence that was presented on the record was that the mother brought KG to the emergency room at Evans Army Community Hospital because KG had excitedly ran up to her and told her about the appellant's acts. At that point, we know it's 29 December 2001. The only evidence we have that she was examined by anybody who was properly qualified was KG's mother, who only testified to a cursory stethoscope examination, that she wasn't seen by anybody who's probably qualified to assess her.
Well, no, wait a minute. The record doesn't say anything about that. So I mean, is this speculation on your part?
Well,
what we know is that she went there for a medical exam, and that's all we know.
And correct, Your Honor, and she did not take her to law enforcement or to a sheriff's office first, but we know by law that once she did go to the emergency room, inevitably we're going to have law enforcement involvement.
I agree with that, but I think isn't the important thing here that the Army Hospital did not make a further referral, or is that of no consequence?
Well, I was just going to add to that, Your Honor, that there is no evidence on this record that the referral to the Children's Advocacy Center occurred by law enforcement. That this child was taken there to a place similar to Rodriguez Rivera, where she could be properly treated for the injuries that her mother believed she had sustained by appellant. There's no evidence, and it was never from Detective Larson, that he directed, initiated, or even conducted, or even participated in this examination. Furthermore, regarding the billing, Your Honor, that evidence was not considered by the military judge at trial. I do not know under this court's power for de novo review that the discussion that the judge had on the record is something for this court to consider. But I would say, assuming arguendo it did, that referral, as you, Your Honor, alluded to, the referral by law enforcement doesn't turn a primary purpose of medical diagnosis and treatment into a prosecutorial one. In fact, here, the billing statement was taken off the PE1 before it was admitted into evidence. It was marked for P2 identification, and the judge didn't consider it before coming back with his findings.
Are you familiar with our case in Brisbane, where we addressed whether a social worker needed to give Article 31 rights?
I'm not familiar with that case, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
I've heard of it, but the specifics of what, no, Your Honor. But I would say, Your Honor, what is alluded by this court and what its focus should be is what held in Rankin was, what was the primary purpose behind that? And that primary purpose, Judge Gerber, is not looking at who referred the child. It's certainly something that can be taken a factor. But as long as the primary purpose was for medical diagnosis and treatment as it was here, a secondary purpose obviously is going to be law enforcement involvement from the point that the victim is brought to an emergency room at a hospital or any Army installation or any sister service office-wide. But that's a secondary purpose. But so long as the primary purpose is for medical diagnosis and treatment, that's the focus that this court should have in determining whether KG statements are testimonial or not.
And so, I mean, it's interesting that the initial examination or the initial questioning at the Children's Advocacy Center was conducted by law enforcement. Is that not true?
No, Your Honor. What happened here and what we know from the record is that the mother brought the child on 29 December 2001. The facts are actually very similar to this court in the United States versus Rodriguez Rivera. The child was brought by the mother to the emergency room. We know from this KG's mother that some cursory examination occurred, but it was really only a stethoscope. We have no witnesses from the Evans Army Community Hospital testified on the merits. Nothing to indicate what a diagnosis was or there. What we do know is that 4 days later, on 2 January, that yes, she was given a videotape statement that was taken by Detective Larson and by Ms. Denise Cheney of DHS. But, Your Honor, this will constitute, the government will submit, contrast the highlight of the difference between testimonial and non-testimonial. Certainly those videotape statements, where it's been given in the course of a law enforcement interrogation by Detective Larson, the sole purpose here of interviewing that victim, that are testimonial statements. But that doesn't turn those into where now we have Ms. Siever specifically testifying that she's eliciting these statements for purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment. We have no evidence of law enforcement involved in the examination. In fact, this court knows that. If you look at P1 in evidence, Ms. Siever specifically said that she conducted this examination alone and that she elicited these statements because she needed to. Amicus is focusing on the fact that she had to be qualified as an expert, as well as appellant's counsel, that in order to be qualified as a thing, which she testified to, that inevitably, yes, she goes around and teaches at the state. But again, that doesn't make her referral and turn non-testimonial statements into a testimonial one. She testified that she was the nurse practitioner on call that day. There's no evidence Detective Larson had any contact and said, you're going to conduct this examination. And furthermore, there's no evidence that Ms. Siever came out of that examination and came back and said, do you have any more questions that you want me to ask you? Appellant's counsel is focusing relying on Blue versus North Dakota. That highlights the point the government's making here. There, during the examination, it was a two-way mirror where the law enforcement is watching as examination is being conducted. That certainly is not evident here. We know that
you would agree that the nurse testifies that she is conducting a forensic evaluation. And she does say that. The question is perhaps whether it's the primary purpose or not. You're not arguing that she wasn't conducting a forensic evaluation.
I would say she's conducting, Your Honor, a medical examination. If the form refers to forensic...
What is her answer on record 232 to conduct a forensic evaluation and detailed genital examination mean?
I would say yes, Your Honor. Yes, I'd say certain aspects, Your Honor, yes, that they are for a forensic evaluation, but that was not the primary purpose for while she elicited these statements.
Okay, that's a different argument than arguing it's not forensic at all.
No, Your Honor.
Was there does the record reflect that there was further medical referral after this examination?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. If you look at page 255 of the record of trial, you will see that social worker in this case, Dr. Lehman, testified that in his initial state meeting with KG on 11 February with her mother, that he's told her the reasons why she's being seen. And that was that the statements that she specifically gave at the Children's Advocacy Center. We also know that to be the case, Your Honor, for follow-up treatment, because PE1, the forensic examination form that she filled out, was forwarded to Evans Community Hospital, where Dr. Lehman works. So we have that evidence here to show that there was follow-up treatment here, Your Honor. Certainly, a reasonable inference here is that that was forwarded and that she could properly see, as he testified to, psychological treatment for the statements that she, KG, specifically made to Ms. Severs.
Counsel, is it possible we have a gap here, and if we do, whether we are the ones to fill it? And by the gap, I mean the case was tried before Crawford was decided. So at that time, was it the government's burden at that point to prove that a medical exception to the hearsay rule existed? Is that what the government had to prove at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the government has to prove that. And is there a gap between what the government was required to prove for the medical exception and what is necessary to demonstrate primary purpose under Crawford and Davis? I'm not saying whether there's a gap, asking whether there's a gap in this case, but is there at least a theoretical gap that is the government could introduce evidence sufficient in an Ohio against Roberts situation to have the evidence admitted as a hearsay exception to the medical purpose, that there was a medical purpose there, but not be sufficient for meeting the primary purpose test under Crawford and Davis?
I would say, Your Honor, that's a possibility, but I think the proper focus for this court is, as it held in U.S. v. Rankin, is that it's a contextual analysis approach and looking primarily at what was the primary purpose behind these statements. If they were non-testimonial, then the availability of KG would have been irrelevant in this case. If this court were to determine, looking at the videotape statement, that we believe these statements to be non-testimonial, there would be no issue as to its erroneous submission.
Okay, let's assume that they're testimonial then. How do we then resolve the matter as to whether this record is sufficient to demonstrate primary purpose?
I would say, Your Honor, you have to consider both the who is eliciting these questions as well as the expectation of the individual who is making those statements, but looking at who that person is, their age, the circumstances that are occurring here. A lot of the cases, Your Honor, that we focus on what this court is confronted with is putting out some military courts. We have a hybrid between sort of forensic, as Judge Baker alluded to, and purely medical or medical. Inevitably, you have lots of teams who work together to assist a child victim or adult victim out here. I think it's this court's focus in laying out, when dealing with the medical diagnosis of hearsay exception, what the focus for that test is, and that primary purpose behind which those statements were made.
I may have misspoken in saying assuming testimonial, because of course that would be necessary in deciding whether it's testimonial. And my question is, under the Supreme Court's decision in Davis, do we have any authority in this court to not apply a primary purpose test?
I would say
is there any unique military circumstance at play here? Are we not operating in a straightforward evidentiary constitutional setting without regard to unique military circumstances, at least in this case?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
Then in those circumstances, if the Supreme Court has said that the concern here is primary purpose, while there may be some aspect in detecting primary purpose from what the witness's expectations are, how significant could that be in a situation where the person who knows what the purpose is the person who is asking the questions? If we had, for example, a situation in which the person asking the question would acknowledge that their primary purpose was law enforcement, would it make any difference what the subjective view was of a child or an adult or anyone else being questioned?
I would say, Your Honor, the only way to determine that, in other words, if that person's under oath or why Ms. Severs, if you believe that she's lying, and there's subterfuge, I think...
Let's assume she's telling the truth and that she's very honest about what she's conducting. You're not asking to concede that here, but very honest about what she's saying, and the court would conclude that her primary purpose there was for law enforcement. Why would it make any difference what the person who was being questioned at that point, a child, an adult who's being questioned by a nurse, etc., thought, even if they thought they were giving something for medical purposes, if the person asking the question said, I'm doing this for law enforcement, they might not say it quite that bluntly, but the court came to that conclusion, why isn't that determinative under Crawford and Davis?
I think, Your Honor, because there's other factors inevitably that this court would have to consider, as it alluded to in a contextual analysis for Rankin and the excited business records exception there, and as Davis and Hammond dealing with a similar contextual analysis with the excited utterance rule, when dealing here for the first time with medical diagnosis and treatment with non-law enforcement personnel, in that sense, in dealing with contextual analysis, how else are we to determine for this court what a reasonable person in the declarant's position would believe, considering that in this situation, Ms. Severs testifying as to the primary purpose why she was asking these questions. The only way this court can determine, or for courts to determine, the responses given that those weren't violating the appellant's Sixth Amendment rights is to consider the other factors surrounding the circumstances for when the statements were made.
Counsel, Davis certainly stands for the proposition that when the primary purpose of the questioning is law enforcement, that would be testimonial, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it rule out the possibility that you could have dual purposes, and so long as one of them was law enforcement, that would also make a testimonial?
No, it does not, Your Honor. Certainly it won't be ruled out. We have to look at the, again, as this court held in Rankin and similarly here, as to the facts surrounding who was the person who was eliciting these statements and the reasons for it. In order to make that determination whether or not they're acting in concert with that individual when they're not law enforcement, they're not a sheriff or police officer, this court have to look at the surrounding circumstances to determine in the end are they acting in concert. In the cases that we cited, this court has held, there was law enforcement in the original medical history obtained, and those courts in Supreme Court in Ohio and the Commonwealth of Oliveira for the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, those courts have held nonetheless, even with a limited law enforcement involvement there during the initial medical history, it didn't transform those statements and that primary purpose from a medical one, Your Honor, to a prosecutorial one.
No, but what I'm saying is if there's a prosecutorial purpose at all with respect to the elicitation or eliciting testimony from a witness, doesn't that implicate the concerns that the Supreme Court talked about in Crawford and Davis? Or are you saying it has to be that as long as the medical purpose is primary and the law enforcement purpose is secondary, that we don't get into the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause analysis?
That's correct, Your Honor. So long as the primary purpose, as Judge Baker alluded to, long as the primary purpose here is for medical diagnosis and treatment, which it was here, and what the evidence shows, inevitably, Your Honor, there's going to be a memorialization here that the statements that KG made to Ms. Severs could be later used at trial. But so long as the primary purpose is for medical diagnosis and treatment, that doesn't violate the appellant's Sixth Amendment right of confrontation.
Is there a distinction between a forensic medical exam and a medical exam?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say there could be a hybrid. In other words, you could have, as this form is listed as a forensic examination form. Now, Ms. Severs testified that this is the standard form that they use for child adults. It's a medical...
She conducted a forensic exam.
Evaluation, yes, Your Honor.
And so, obviously, it would be easier from your position if the form said medical exam and she said that she conducted a medical exam. And I'm trying to find out how important is it that the forms and the references made here were forensic.
I would say a purely forensic, Your Honor, would be that document specifically states it will only be used for law enforcement proceedings or for a court-martial. But whereas here the results are sent to not just to law enforcement, but to DHS, to other agencies, and particularly here to her primary care physician, and ultimately as she received follow-up treatment on the basis of that certainly would not make it purely forensic.
But isn't Crawford in part trying to get at circumstances where, regardless of whether it's primary or hybrid or whatever, there are incentives or pressures where government officials know something's going to be used at a trial? Crawford's trying to get at eliminating the pressures to generate evidence, because evidence is intended, testimonial evidence is intended to be tested in a particular manner. So how do you address that? Even if, let's for sake of argument, 50-50. Nobody can, there's not primary anything. But certainly the nurse knew this would be used at trial. Are you arguing she would not know that as a forensic person?
I would say she would knew of the possibility that it could be used at a later trial. Obviously, it's the prosecutor's discretion to decide where this case would be brought.
But certainly a nurse who had testified 50 times at trial and was in this business would know that there was a fair probability, to mix legal metaphors or whatever, that this would be used at a trial if there was a trial.
Yes, Your Honor, that certainly is a possibility.
And Crawford is intended to get at that in some manner, to protect a process by to prevent law enforcement from generating evidence rather than having the evidence come to them in essence. How do you react to that?
The way for that, Your Honor, is that we have to look at it from the perspective that, as the Supreme Court held in Davis and Hammond in its final analysis, say, would a reasonable person in the declarant's position believe, based on all the facts and circumstances of contextual analysis, that in the end, were these statements, would that person know if these statements are going to be used later in prosecution?
So if I understand your position, you're saying that can all be true, but as long as the person making the statement isn't affected by that, then it's not an issue.
Yes, Your Honor. That goes back
to your emphasis on reasonable witness.
And that goes back to yours and Judge Erzman's questions relating to sort of a secondary outcome or a secondary purpose behind these statements is, yes, they could be used later at trial. And that is that in the sense that they're memorialized. But so long as the evidence shows that the primary purpose behind for which those statements were made is for medical diagnosis and treatment here, those statements are non-testimonial and should be admitted under the medical diagnosis exception to hearsay rule.
Your time has expired, but we have not explored the third issue yet, and I do not intend to carry this on much longer unless my colleagues want to. But I give you the opportunity now to conclude with respect to all the issues and issue three as well. And in doing so, if you would address with respect to issue three, if we conclude that the statement on January 3rd should have been preceded by a rights warning, then why would the January 7th statement be admissible?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, first, Your Honors, whatever approach this court decides to take in conducting its harmless error analysis, the end result here is the same. That the erroneous admission of KG's videotaped statement was harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt because it contributed little, if any, and did not have a substantial impact on the findings or sentence. Second, the military judge, Your Honors, did not abuse his discretion in admitting KG's statements to Ms. Sievers because the primary purpose behind those statements was to allow Ms. Sievers to determine whether there was abuse, whether KG had been injured, and whether she needed follow-up treatment, which she, in fact, received. Finally, Your Honor, both of the appellant's statements were the military judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting both of these statements because both of those statements were given voluntarily based on the totality of the circumstance. Sir, I won't go into the findings, Your Honor.
I do have a question on that. And under Rule 304B of the Military Rules of Evidence, if a warning wasn't given, you don't look at the totality of the circumstances. The statement's inadmissible.
Well, Your Honor, certainly here, in looking at that analysis, is to say that he was specifically told at the station on why it is that the law enforcement wanted to speak to him. And so in that sense, his Article 31 rights and what were given were met here.
So your argument is that 31B was complied with as opposed to totality of the circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And is that based on the two Miranda warnings plus the information of what he was being accused or what he was being investigated for?
Yes, Your Honor.
I have, if you don't mind, one question about the January 3 statement. Is it your view that there was one interrogation, two interrogations, three interrogations? How many interrogations were there on that day?
I would say zero interrogations, Your Honor. He was specifically told he was not in custody. It was a specific finding of fact by the judge. He was free to leave at any time, and he was specifically told that by Detective Larson. So he was, as the judge properly found, was not in custody, and that these Miranda warnings were gratuitous.
Okay, well, let me use the word interview. How many interviews did he have? And, you know, when, I guess what my question is, when the military investigator asked him questions and he wrote a handwritten statement, was that a continuation of the interviews he had before then and the lie detector he had before then, or is it something new?
I think it's a continuation, Your Honor.
I thought that the military judge found this was not a joint investigation at that time.
Correct, Your Honor. It wasn't a joint investigation.
How can it then be a continuation of something that wasn't?
In the sense that he was, the appellant, after being initially questioned by Detective Larson, was then asked if he would voluntarily submit to a lie detector test, which he agreed to. He was then again read his Miranda warnings, which the appellant waived, and which the judge found was specifically in his findings of fact. He then, at the conclusion of that interview, Detective, in this case, the special agent, CID Agent Phillips, was there present, and then was outside the interview room, and so in that sense it continued. In other words, it wasn't a large transfer of time before an hour or so, or brought back later. Meanwhile, questioning continued. It came in right after the results came back for the lie detector test and some additional questioning by Detective Larson.
Okay, so we're assuming that we don't buy that, and that we think that there's no such thing as substantial compliance with Article 31B, that you have to give specific Article 31B rights. If we had that position, why does the January 7th statement still come in?
Because, again, you know, on 7 January, who specifically read his Article 31B rights, he was told again that by Agent Phillips for why he wanted him to come down. He asked him if he would again come down voluntarily, and he was told, I want to ask you further questions relating to allegations of sexual abuse involving KG.
And so, why doesn't it matter that he gave a statement on January 3rd that at least in theory was not properly warned?
I think the rights and warning in that case, he gave Ms. Miranda an Article 31, ma'am, on 7 January were sufficient that it didn't require a cleansing warning or anything relating back to his 3 January statement.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the additional time that you've given us here today.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honor, turning to the second issue, the objective purpose or state of mind of the questioner, appellant notes or cites two specific things within the record trial that demonstrate that there is not, in fact, a primary purpose. Or if you look at the pretrial documents, a couple things are brought forth. Number one, there is, in fact, a statement and also analysis of what exactly occurred at the Evans Community Hospital on the initial day that KQ was brought in. There was, in fact, a full medical examination conducted.
What about record 241 when Nurse Seaver says, one of the reasons that we explain to a child what's going on is so that they have an understanding, so that they're not afraid. And we also elicit a history in order to determine diagnosis and treatment. So those are the primary reasons for getting a history from the child, as well as getting information from the mother. Now, note the use of the phrase primary. How do you address that?
Well, Your Honor, we address it twofold. Number one, obviously, this is an objective test. And the reason is, as was brought forth in Rodriguez-Rivera, which is the concern that of a pretext, meaning that somebody just explaining that this was for medical purposes when it otherwise wasn't. So again, we need to look at it from objectively. And if we look at it objectively, other facts that this court should consider was obviously Detective Larson, in fact, set up this medical examination. It's both in the pretrial documents. It's an appendix to Appellate Exhibit 4, marked for identification, which is admitted into evidence, which was he, in fact, after his initial videotape interview with KG, set up the interview because he wanted to find out, and this is his quote, "I wanted to find out if there were any genital findings, if there were any vaginal damage." He then set up the interview. Upon that, what occurs is there's a small interlude where there's a question and answer period between KT's mother.
I understand the other facts. Just with respect to that statement, is your position that that's fine, but Nurse Seavers wasn't addressing the Crawford issue, or?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, again, there could be, as I explained before, there could be derivative purposes, meaning that one of her purposes could be for medical treatment. But again, if we look at it objectively, everything else indicates that the primary purpose was, in fact, towards some sort of criminal prosecution or investigation. We could also look at what occurred immediately thereafter, which was she forwarded that document, and this is based upon the testimony of special, not special, Detective Larson, immediately to Detective Larson. So this was not only forwarded, obviously, to Evans Community Hospital and to two investigative agencies, but immediately to Detective Larson. Also, if you
wait, was that at the same time that it was forwarded to the social worker? Or was that, did that come later? Or what does the record reflect on that?
Your Honor, the record really reflects two things. The actual document reflects that this was forwarded to the Evans Community Hospital, to the actual social work agency, and also, obviously, to the detective agency, the El Paso Detective Agency. But during the actual statements from Detective Larson, excuse me, he in fact states that immediately upon the completion of this, it was forwarded to my office. We can also look at the actual document.
If you have mixed purposes, medical and prosecutorial, to the effect that you really can't parse them out, you know, 60-40, 55-45, what have you, where do we go? Does any substantial amount of law enforcement purpose taint the whole thing, or on the contrary, does any substantial amount of medical purpose immunize the whole thing? What are we supposed to do in a situation where the whole thing is radically intermixed?
Your Honor, I think we need to err on the side of what Crawford errs for, which is the concern of overburdening of the Sixth Amendment rights, which is accused rights not only to confront his witness, but also the concern for prosecutorial abuse. And that's precisely what we have in this type of case. And it's obviously difficult for the case when we don't have an analysis of testimony versus non-testimonial. But we have sufficient evidence here to demonstrate that, in fact, the primary purpose was for investigating. We can also look at the document. There was no, in fact, follow-up examination or inquiry on the part of Ms. Severs in the record. There was no testing for venereal diseases. So everything that indicates within that document, and also pursuant to her statements and testimony, indicates that this was really...
So what you're saying is you don't have that situation here.
Yes,
you have something that is patently prosecutorial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In this case, and I would say in general, when we have a situation like this, it should err on the side of caution and err toward...
Well, we don't need to talk in general. We're talking about this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And to the first issue, the government seems to want to go through a Article 66 review, which is, let's retry this case. That's not, it's their burden to demonstrate that this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, not the appellant's burden to demonstrate that this piece of evidence played no role. That's not the legal standard that's set forth either by this court in Simmons or by the Supreme Court in Chapman, or for that matter, the Supreme Court's decision thereafter.
Counsel, your time has expired, and you may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. To the videotape statement from KG and how that was in fact not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Two, that obviously Ms. Severs' testimony should be considered testimonial. And in light of not only that piece of evidence, but also the piece of evidence of the videotape statement, that could not be considered harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And also, obviously, the Article 31 rights not being read on 3 January 2002, that being obviously inadmissible, and under the totality of circumstances on the United States versus Phillips, that it should be found that, obviously, his second statement should also be ruled non-voluntary and therefore inadmissible. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentations here today, and counsel for the amicus. We thank you for the presentation and for the brief. The case is now submitted. We are very privileged to be here and honored to be at Duquesne Law School, a school which has contributed much to the national field of law and to military lawyers in particular. When the clerk recesses the court, the judges will remain in place for a Q&A session. We recognize that this being an academic environment, some of you may have to leave for other obligations. We hope that doesn't trigger a mass exodus, but we'll be glad to remain in place to answer questions about everything except for the case today. So with that note, the clerk will order a recess of the court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.